Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. To celebrate Paul McCartney's 80th birthday, over four episodes I'll be speaking to a potpourri of delicious guests who'll be choosing their favourite Fab Macca song. We'll also be hearing from lots of Egg Pod listeners who picked a song that means the most to them. So let's get part three underway. Take it away, Egg Podders!
There were rules you never told me. Never came up with a plan. All the stories that you told me didn't help me understand. But I had to get.
This is Amy, and my song of choice by Paul is Queenie Eye from 2013's New. I like the song for many reasons. It's quite a personal song which references his childhood and remembrances of playing a game that uses the words Queenie Eye. And I also like it because Paul tends to throw a couple of curveballs in it, one being he gets very soft in the middle of the song, despite the punchiness of it overall. I really enjoy the fact that he is making it sound somewhat vintage, but also somewhat very of today's sound. So for all those reasons, my song for Paul is Queenie Eye.
My name's Dylan Crawford, I'm from Brisbane, Australia, and I've chosen A Love For You, which is a hidden McCartney gem from 1970. It was recorded during the sessions for Ram, but it wasn't released until 2003. This is a song I can happily listen to over and over again. It's one of those catchy, melodic songs that Paul seems to do so easily. As always, it has a great vocal. Musically, it's quite upbeat and cheery, with some nice piano and guitar accompaniment. But this is balanced by lyrics which are a bit more downbeat, seeming to portray a friendship that he's in fear of losing. Given that it was written in the midst of the Beatles' breakup, I can't help but hear the song as A Love For John. If you've heard it 100 times or haven't heard it at all, have a listen to A Love For You.
Single pigeon through the railings, did she throw you out? Sunday morning fight about Saturday night.
Hi, my name is Mike Brüggemeier, and I want to talk about the song Single Pigeon from the Red Rose Speedway album, an underrated song from an underrated album, in a long tradition of great McCartney songs about birds. I love the melancholy mood of this. After a fight with his lover, a man is strolling along Regent Canal on an early rainy Sunday morning, trying to cheer himself up. It's a slight song, not even 2 minutes long, just the voice and the piano, not perfectly sung. Paul almost misses his entry in the second verse, but I love the understatement and the casualness and how Linda echoes Paul in the chorus, and when the brass section sets in the end, it's just perfect to me.
Every day she takes a morning bath, she wets her hair, wraps a towel around her as she's heading for the bedroom chair. It's just another day.
Hello Chris, Ian Kinsey here. The song I wish to talk about is Another Day, the first single after the Beatles' split. Brilliant song, so complex, sounds beautifully simple, which of course is exactly what McCartney kind of represents so often. We have key changes, time signature changes, we have this story of the young woman who's looking for love. Again, he's making a kind of romance out of the mundane. Beautifully produced, great singing from Linda, the harmonies, and brilliant bass playing as always. So it's a double thumbs up from me.
Hi, Broderick Harper here, aka at Bro Harper Bantam. For me, it's the underrated Good Times Coming and Feel the Sun off the equally underrated Press the Play album. What's poignant to me here is that in the first part, we have Paul reminiscing positively about summers and holidays when he was younger, which is just what I do. The line that was a golden summer, wasn't it hot, is of course how people like Paul and I, who had happy childhoods, look back at that time. In the second part, we have an older Paul though, asking, will it ever be the same? Clearly, the actual reality of life has bitten, and now he's playing the role of keeping our spirits up and reminding us to feel the sun. Typical Paul, simple, classic McCartney.
I can wait another day until I call you. You've only got my heart on a string and everything a flutter. But another lonely night might take forever. We've only got each other to blame. It's all the same to me, love, 'cause I know what I feel.
Writer, broadcaster and podcaster, Andy Dawson. What song have you picked?
I have picked No More Lonely Nights from 1984. And I think I picked it because at the time it was a song that I just really loved it. It was a big chart hit. It was a period of a lot of chart activity for Paul. But it's also, looking back now, it's kind of the end of an era, almost, of him being a major force in the singles chart, because he'd done Pipes of Peace the Christmas before, which was number one, and then this came out along with the film Give My Regards to Broad Street, and then quickly after this was We All Stand Together, and then that whole era of him being a major player in the singles chart in the UK just ended. And he only had one more solo top 10 hit after We All Stand Together, after this 1984 period, which was Once Upon a Long Ago. So it's kind of, it's like he always had that ability. He didn't, not everything he did was a hit, but he had that ability, I think, to just reach into his bag and knock out a chart hit. Whether it was deliberately or whether it was just how he did things, but you look through the 70s and there was some chart hits. Mull of Kintyre was the first time I became aware of McCartney, because I was five and it was number one forever in 1977. But things like Silly Love Songs and Let Him In, and then Wonderful Christmas Time coming up, through to things like Say, Say, Say. Every year or so there'd be a big top five McCartney hit. And this is kind of the last one of those. So there's a kind of a bit of a sadness looking back at it now, that that era, which had began almost a quarter of a century beforehand, had come to an end, but we didn't really realise it. But I love this song. It's just an unashamed ballad. It's a great love song. It's very much on the right side of being kind of syrupy and mawkish, but at the same time, it's just one of those songs that isn't ashamed to be what it is. What it is on its sleeve, and says, you know, this is a love song, it's a romantic ballad, take it or leave it. And I just think it's a gorgeous song. I haven't let you say anything yet, Chris. You should probably say something if you've got anything you want to say. I don't know. Sorry.
Well, just a little bit of history, really, because it's, like you say, yeah, it's released on the 24th September 1984. Amazingly, it's recorded in 3 hours.
Yeah.
Produced by George Martin and engineered by Jeff Emmerich. And as you said, it's a huge success. It got to number two. Do you know what held it off the top?
Wasn't it Wham! Freedom?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, which in itself was a huge hit that year. So if you're going to get knocked off the top or held off the top by something, it's going to have to be something big. Well, I mean, Frankie Goes to Hollywood were number one for most of 1984, but and Wham! So it was going to be one of those two. But
that was it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it could quite easily have been a number one in the mould of Pipes of Peace. It's in that kind of genre of, like I say, big hit singles that he used to do.
No more lonely night, never be another. No more lonely night. You're my guiding light, day or night, I'm always there.
Let me say, it was the lead single from Give My Regards to Broad Street. And, you know, with the video and the song, I remember seeing the video at the time thinking, God, that film looks awesome. I can't wait to see that film. It's going to be brilliant. Yeah. And like you said, then in November, wasn't it, We Will Stand Together. So I think it was a combination of the failure of the film with, and I remember people playing it on the radio, We Will Stand Together. I think it was John Sachs on Capital Radio, I remember playing it, saying this is the worst thing he's ever done. And it seemed to be from there on until pretty well mid-90s, I think, when Britpop really, that reinvigorated him. But he was seen by many almost as a joke. You forget nowadays.
Ridiculous. Because I remember when he recorded with, he wrote with Elvis Costello for Flowers in the Dirt, and it was almost seen as Elvis Costello giving him a helping hand almost.
Yes.
And kind of trying to restore his credibility. When in truth, you know, that didn't need to be the case at all. But it was a good collaboration for the pair of them. But we all stand together. I know we're not talking about that song, but that attitude that it's rubbish still annoys me to this day. It's a kid's song. Yeah. It's a song for kids. If you don't like it, it's not for you. You're probably not a kid. It's a great song. Leave it alone.
Absolutely. One thing, I mean, you've obviously seen the recent Get Back movie. You've actually got the mug as well.
I'm drinking from the mug right now, yeah.
This will be delighted for vibes. You see John talking about when they've finished it, they're going to do like a multimedia thing, so it's going to be like a book, a film, and obviously the album. And that, I think, was inspired by Alan Klein, who was going to do the same thing with the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus.
Yeah.
But Paul, I mean, this album was a multimedia. You've got a film, an album, a book, and the ZX Spectrum game as well.
I mean, I bought the single. I didn't go and see the film at the time. I don't know whether it was age appropriate or not. I don't know what the certificate was for it. I was 11 at the time. Yeah. But the ZX Spectrum game I very much did play, and it was pretty duff. It wasn't good. It was. I think you had to go. It was kind of like, it's just the same sort of plot as the film. You had to go around London trying to track down some master tapes, and it was just, no. It was no Jet Set Willy, put it that way.
Does this ring any bells for you? Hold on.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah. So this is a playthrough of the whole game on YouTube, I guess. And you can relive that nightmarish experience all over again.
There's a lovely quote, because obviously we've got that amazing solo from David Gilmour at the end, and David Gilmour was saying, I found it quite amazing doing No More Lonely Nights with Paul McCartney. In 1 3-hour session with the band, we learnt it, put it down, Paul played piano, sang the lead vocal live, and I put the guitar solo down, bang.
Yeah.
And it's unfathomable, 3 hours.
But it doesn't sound like that. It doesn't sound like that at all. It sounds quite lush and not overproduced, but it sounds like it's been, you know, worked on, worked at. But then again, I love it so much because it is quite a simple song and it doesn't try to pretend that it's something it isn't, like I said before. So I was quite surprised because I didn't know that about the 3-hour session, but that's like really, really nice to know. It enhances the song even more. And of course, there was the B-side as well, which was the version that was played out at the end of the film, which is a funky version of the song. I played it quite a bit at the time because I had the 7-inch single and it was the B-side. I don't like it as much as the A-side, but it's got a lot going for it. And there was a separate video for it as well, which has got Paul and Linda in it together and lots of archive footage of people dancing and having fun, black and white footage that used to be quite popular of dropping into videos to create an atmosphere of enjoyment. And there's some people breakdancing in it as well, which of course was very fashionable at the time, so it's very much of its time compared to the A side, which has got a classic feel about it. But yeah, I like the B side as well. It's all good.
Just briefly on the film, I mean, this was a failure and it was really criticised at the time. Amazing cast. You got like Linda, George Martin, Ringo, Barbara Buck, along with Brian Brown, Tracy Altman, Ralph Richardson, Giant Haystacks, and Dr. Leg from EastEnders.
You're never going to get that group of people together in a movie unless Paul McCartney's made the phone call, put it that way. Especially Giant Haystacks, because he did not just turn up for any old movie. Yeah. You know, that'd be special for Haystacks to commit to it. But it, yeah, it's not a great film, but it's watchable in a curious kind of way.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen it for a while, and I've got no desire to watch it again anytime soon. But yeah, it is what it is.
It is. So, No More Lonely Nights. What does this song mean to you?
It was just that thing of Paul McCartney just knocking out a really, really gorgeous song and it being a hit single in that way that he had the ability to do. And he had the ability to do that for decades. And it was just, for me, it's overlooked. And it was just a prime example of peak McCartney, I think.
Yeah. And finally, Paul McCartney at 80. Why do you think Paul's music has endured for all these years?
That's a good question. I'm going to think about that. I mean, I think the Beatles were a once-in-a-century thing. Not a once-in-a-generation, a once-in-a-century thing. And they'll still be talked about in centuries to come. And obviously it was a Lennon-McCartney thing mainly, but Paul's songs were a massive part of why they were so successful. And he's never gone away. He's never gone away. He's never lost his mojo. He's had sort of fallow periods and dips. But, you know, he's got that national treasure status now, and it's well-earned. I mean, I took my daughter, who's now 18, took her to see Paul play in Glasgow a few years ago because I wanted her to be able to say when she's 90 or whatever, in 2093, I saw a Beatle in concert. But people say, but the Beatles, but that was 130 years ago. How can that be?
Yeah.
They say, oh, I was there. So they're just timeless. The songs are timeless, and he's always had that ability and that knack to write really, really great melodic songs, and you can't underestimate that.
Andy Dawson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
They can't take it from me if they try. I lived through those early days.
I'm podcaster Phoebe Lord from Another Kind of Mind, and I've chosen Early Days, a gently powerful song about the pain of being erased, of having an epic, world-changing relationship distorted and exploited by outsiders who ignore your recollections and create their own versions of your story, about having to witness this and live through it and struggle to retain your sanity in the midst of this nightmare. But it's also about the eternal power of love, the serenity of knowing, the strength and sincerity of that love, and the belief that no one can ever take that love away. McCartney has been more famous for more time than almost anyone on the planet. His story is unique, and Early Days is a uniquely personal story, but we all know the bittersweet joy of cherished memories. And if you're in the rarefied position of needing to defend your most precious memories and friendships from the judgment of strangers, that's a fight worth fighting. And for Paul McCartney, what better way to do it than through song?
Give me a hand, I'd like to shake it. I want to show you I'm your friend. You'll understand.
Hello there, my name is Caitlin Mulligan and I decided to pick the song Put It There. I've only heard the song 2.5 times and I know, but I heard it for the first time over the weekend whilst I was watching the Get Back tour from the 1990s, and yeah, it just struck me as a sweet song and I love it whenever he does that guitar plug in. I think it's great and a good job, so yeah. But it also has a familiar melody that you feel like you heard before, but then you're like, no, I didn't hear this before. But then you're like, maybe it did play on the radio, but I just wasn't paying attention. So, yeah, I'm really enjoying the song, and I think it could become a favourite. So put it there.
Hi, Chris. My favourite Paul track is Put It There off the Flowers in the Dirt album. It's a lovely, gentle, soothing acoustic number, very stripped back compared to the production on the rest of the album. And it weaves in Paul's very strong family values once again, which is found throughout a lot of his solo work, as it was a saying that his dad used when he was a kid. And I had the pleasure of performing the track live a number of years ago at my mother-in-law's birthday party. My mother-in-law, lovely Rita. And the birthday party was at a place called Clark's Gardens in Allerton, which is only a 5-minute drive away from Forthlyn Road, where Paul grew up. So it's nice to have that song with its strong connections with Liverpool being played around where Paul lived. Great track with lots of special memories for me.
Hi Chris, this is Richard Bowes here, or RB Music Writer on Twitter. Favourite Paul McCartney solo songs? I mean, the list is endless really, you know, I went back and forth as to which one it would be. You know, it could be Sliding, could be Waterfalls, Temporary Secretary, but I think the one for me that really sticks out is Young Boy. Growing up of the Britpop generation in the early 90s, it wasn't cool to like the Beatles, even though I kind of been, you know, had them as part of my fabric through listening to my dad. But after Come Together with as the Smoking Mojo Filters with Paul Weller and Noel Gallagher, all of a sudden Paul McCartney was cool again, and then he released Young Boy in 97, and it was just great to see him back kind of front and center and be given all the accolades that he deserved. And not only that, but it's such a great song, and it really kind of brought back Paul McCartney's kind of zest for life. You know, post anthology, he sounded a lot freer, I think a lot more inspired, and it was a successful comeback for what was a great album. Love the pod, keep up the good work.
I'm Daphne Mitchell from the Another Kind of Mind podcast, and I've chosen the song Tomorrow. Tomorrow is a beautiful construction with many McCartney hallmarks, a lovely melody, gorgeous backing harmonies, and an evocative, nature-centered lyric with some pleasingly surrealist touches. I am also always a sucker for Paul's facility with internal rhymes, which are woven throughout Tomorrow, very much as in No One and Mother Nature's Son. But what really makes the song fascinating are Paul's production and performance choices. Tomorrow has a pretty lilting melody, and Paul could easily have treated it like Mother Nature's Son, for example, but he doesn't. He does not sing it with his pretty lilting voice that we are all very familiar with. His voice sounds strangled, like he's not in control of it. He could almost be on the verge of tears, like someone who's been up all night fending off a mental breakdown with coffee and cigarettes, but now his date has arrived at the door, so he's pretending everything is great and he's totally relaxed and ready for their picnic. And of course, there's his desperate plea to his love not to let him down, repeated over and over and over again with increasing intensity and desperation, until finally he's screaming so loud he's literally overloading the microphone. Then the song winds down to its outro, and just when you think it's over, he comes screaming back with another outro of soulful begging, just to be sure his point got across. Like many of Paul's love songs, Tomorrow is not as simple or as light as it might seem. For those willing to look for it, there is great wit and depth to be found in Paul's work. Wit and depth and authentic, vulnerable self-expression.
At the end of the end, it's the start of a journey to a much better place. And this wasn't bad, so a much better place would have to be special. No need to be sad.
Next we have musician and writer Martin Carr. Recorded at Abbey Road at the end of February 2004 and released on Paul's 2007 album, Memory Almost Full. You've picked The End of the End. Why did you pick this one?
It's one of my favourite songs of his. I've never really heard anything like it that he'd done before. And I'm not a big solo guy. I hadn't listened to an album since Tug of War. No, what's the one before Tug of War?
McCartney 2?
What's the one after Tug of War?
Pipes of Peace?
It's Tug of War. I got that for Christmas when I was, you know, wherever it was, 14. And I still love that album, but never really bothered with it, his other solo stuff. And then I can't remember where I first heard Memory Almost Full. I decided that I was going to dive in. It's a really good album.
Mm.
This song it knocked me off my feet. It really did. I've never heard him sing something so profound.
On the day that I die, I'd like jokes to be told and stories of old to be rolled out like carpets the children have played on and laid on while listening to stories of old. At the end of the end, it's the start of a journey to a much better place. And a much better place would have to be special. No reason to cry.
Or, you know, I've never heard him tackle such a big subject before, I don't think, in such a way. And I love the way that it's a celebration rather than... I think mourning is quite... is a solitary thing. I'm not really into this mourning as spectacle like Princess Di was and... Even John Lennon, I remember. You know, it's best when you celebrate the life rather than mourn the death. That's much more of a community type thing. So, and he's just, again, he evokes, you know, the houses of his childhood with relatives everywhere and there's places hanging with smoke and there's, you know, all his drunk uncles and aunties and stories and songs. It's just beautiful. I love it. And then I really hated the whistle solo in the middle at first. It was almost like he thought he was going a bit too far and he wanted to lighten the mood a bit. But I kind of get it now. And I always think that when they whistle, him and John, that they're kind of talking to each other. Well, the whistling in Jealous Guy is obviously about Paul. But, you know, it's about John and George and getting to see them again, Linda. It's nice.
I love the whistling because I think it just highlights Paul's positivity. Despite the fact he's singing such a heartfelt song, he then it's like a jaunty milkman wandering by, you know, disregarding all the troubles.
That's what I didn't like about it at first, but I totally get it now. It's just something that he does, isn't it? They whistle. I've just got to get used to it.
Because Paul said, I'd read something somebody had written about dying and I thought, that's brave. It seemed courageous to deal with the subject rather than just shy away from it. So I fancied looking at it as a subject myself. I like the Irish approach of a wake where it's celebratory. And he's just done it. He said, I thought, well, what would I like? Jokes, a wake, music, rather than everybody sitting around looking glum, saying he was a great guy. Though they can do a bit of that too. So that led into the verse, on the day that I die, I'd like jokes to be told. And stories of old to be rolled out like carpets. But what I think
such
it's
a beautiful line.
It's what's so beautiful is that Paul is singing the words to his family. It's not like a bold statement to the fans. It's a tender, intimate, selfless moment where he's effectively
like a request almost.
Yeah, he's kind of reassuring his children.
Mm-hmm. But also, it's like a list of instructions, which is very Paul.
Yeah. It's recorded at Abbey Road, and Paul's actually playing the same piano that he used on Lady Madonna, which is lovely. And the producer, David Kahn, said, on the end of the end, Paul was singing and playing live, and he had on headphones. After a few takes, he stopped and said he didn't need the headphones since he was just singing and playing. So he took them off and was sitting in the middle of the room at Abbey Road, playing and singing his song, as bare and purely musical as could be. After three takes later, he did the take you hear on the album. The high part at the end was so pure, like a blimp hanging in the air indefinitely. And I was holding my breath as we finished, wondering if it was all going to fall apart, because it was so delicate, but it stood up like iron. He came upstairs, we listened, and that was it. It was done. Boom. Just like that. A lifetime in a moment.
Wow. But he waited 3 years before he put it out.
Yeah, well, he was kind of working on... Chaos and Creation as well around this time.
Right.
So he's flitting between the two albums.
Okay. I wonder what he'd read. It couldn't have been poetry, could it? Because they're all about death.
Yeah.
And so it must have been It must have been a song, I guess.
As you said earlier, it's you don't really get much from Paul. If you want to know the real Paul, you're not going to get anything. And this is as close a song I think you can ever get to knowing his thoughts. And again, it's all positivity.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I agree.
Well, I think the lyrics, again, you think of it as him singing it to his kids, because he did actually play it to his kids. And
did he? Well, did he play it to the recorded version, or did he play it on the Joanna to him?
Well, both, I think. But he said, I've played it to my family, and they find it very moving because, you know, it's dad. Which is pretty heavy. It's your father playing you a song about death.
That's the first album as well, I think, where his voice starts to sound like, you know, an older guy, which really, because I remember afterwards, for quite a long time afterwards, I thought he was just going to drop dead at any minute.
Yes.
Because after you write a song like that, there's nowhere else to go, really.
Yeah. And he didn't even close the album with it. It was an album closer. Yeah. It's just, let's do something a bit positive at the end.
I think he just doesn't like things to sound too important,
like putting Her Majesty on the end.
Yeah, well, this whole thing in Get Back about them going to the desert to play and stuff, it's so on them. That, you know, leave it to Pink Floyd and all that stuff. They are, what he does is important and what he has done is important, but I think that he shies away from thinking that he isn't important to the wider world. Obviously he's important to his family. Occasionally he'll get a bit tetchy and talk about how great they were, and I think when someone criticises the White Album or something. But very modest guy, and he's very down to earth, and kind of that's the way he comes across. And I think a lot of people have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
That it's almost like it's an act that he's down to earth. But he's the same guy that he was 20, 30, 40 years ago. Seems to be anyway.
Yeah. This song is so big when the inevitable day happens. This seems to be the song that people will be putting on. And it's, I love the fact that we can listen to it now and relish him as a, you know, musician, songwriter, man who's changed the course of musical history. And he's singing about, he's kind of, it just feels like he's sort of saying, don't worry, you know, it's going to be fine. And it's that no reason to cry, no need to be sad. It's so comforting.
It is comforting. He is kind of adding a bit of, I mean, it's not hard religion, but it is a bit, you know, there is somewhere better that we're going. But he doesn't belabor the point. I think it would ruin the whole thing if he mentioned anything to do with religion. But obviously it's there, that's what he believes, you know.
Yeah, he's always been ambiguous, hasn't he? I think there was a quote where he said something when he was asked about religion. He said, I don't mind a bit of God, you know. And that was it. He couldn't offend anybody.
I remember something like the late 60s, and he was saying God, you know, is not some old man in the sky. It's like, he could be in that chair or he could be in that table. I really like that one.
Yeah. So, Martin, as a songwriter, what influence has Paul had on you?
I think it's, out of all the things that he does so brilliantly, it's just being able to conjure something up out of nothing, you know, or out of the same. You know, when you learn one of his songs, they're so much easier than you think they're going to be. And it's like he can, you know, everyone's got the same piece of wood and he can just carve something beautiful out of his. Because it's like he's trying to explain to that guy in the film that all the chords are there. They're all on the piano in front of him. And, you know, there's no magic there. But I don't, you know, but somehow he manages to do what he does incredibly well. And that kind of keeps you going, I think, when you think that you've used up all your chords, you've used up all the melodies and words, and you feel like there's nothing else. Which, you start to feel like that after you've only written three songs. You think, God, what am I going to do now? You know, he'll keep you going. And the fact that he's kept going, he was so uncool for, you know, a couple of decades. You know, a figure of fun almost. Just to make me so cross. And even now, you know, whenever you mention him, people are like, oh, frog chorus.
Yeah, still.
But I think the film's going to turn that around quite a lot, because he's just phenomenal in that film. But he's incredible. He's got an incredible gift and he works hard at it. You know, he gets himself into, you see it with when he's writing Get Back, when he comes up with that out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
He gets himself into the zone, which is where you receive these things, you know. You can't just be thinking about something else or doing something else. You've got to get yourself in that room where all the ideas are. And that's, you can see him, he's like trancing out on his bass. Just wait, here I am, you know, to the universe, here I am, what you got?
I think Keith Richards said that as well, doesn't he? In where he writes songs, he said they're all out there and he's just trying to grasp away at them.
Yeah, that is kind of, yeah, Dylan always said that as well. It's kind of a songwritery thing to say because we can't explain it. You can't explain where it comes from. You know, sometimes you amaze yourself. So you have to kind of explain these things in magical ways.
So at the end of the end, what does this song mean to you?
Well, I think like you say about how comforting it is. You know, I don't think anything happens after we die, but if Paul believes that, that's good enough for me. It just, yeah, it nourishes me in that kind of way. And I love the way the poetry just tumbles and rolls. It's one of my favourite lyrics of his.
On the day that I die, I'd like bells to be rung and songs that were sung to be hung out like blankets that lovers have played on and laid on while listening to songs that were sung. At the end of the end, it's the start of a journey to a much better place. And a much better place would have to be special. No reason to cry. No need to be sad. At the end of the end.
Annie Nightingale, you've picked a song from Paul's debut album, McCartney. Which one's that?
The song is Maybe I'm Amazed.
Why this one?
It's always stuck with me since I first heard it. And it intrigues me immensely, almost on the sort of chromatic level originally. I mean, if you said something to me and I went, oh, that's amazing, it would be a statement, you know, that's amazing. Or I'm amazed, you're making a very definite statement. But by saying, maybe I'm amazed, that just shows the whole thing. It's in complete confusion. So I'm always mystified by this sort of, maybe I'm amazed. But I mean, either you're amazed or not sure, then you can't be that amazed. And so it intrigued me that literally the juxtaposition of those two words or three words was sort of very strange and mystifying. And so I had all kinds of theories over the years about what that really meant when Paul was writing the song. Maybe he was actually being very cautious. It's obviously a love song, some song about Linda, but maybe it was saying, I'm not really sure if I want to say how much I love you and I'm going to be very careful and I'm just going to be very offhand about it and say, maybe I'm amazed. Maybe. The use of the word maybe, I just thought was very odd, but very intriguing. And there's no other song on that first album that's anything like it. Obviously, it came along at a very, very difficult time for Paul and obviously the rest of the Beatles. The time the Beatles break up, all the problems with Alan Klein, and the other three people saying we're going with Alan Klein, and Paul wanted to be with Linda's dad because he was a lawyer, and at the time her name was Eastman, and people thought because she was a photographer, this is something to do with Eastman colour film, and all that was all wrong, and all that conjecture. And so, I mean, it's well known now that he was very down and very miserable at the time of that first album, and it got very bad reviews. And it looked as though, having all that thing about did he split them up, or John had, but he hadn't said so, and all that kind of stuff that went on. It was a horrible time for all of them. And the anxiety for all us Beatle fans, or whether it was really over and what would happen in the future, we couldn't. You didn't want to believe that Beatledom was over.
Yeah.
And it was the end of the 60s, it was 1970. Was this the end of the party? So it was all incredibly significant. And that first album did not get well reviewed. After the brilliance of the later Beatles albums, well, all the Beatles albums, but you know, the direction they'd gone since Pepper and then the White Album and all that stuff, this felt very domesticated. The fact he played every instrument on this, it was very lo-fi, deliberately, mostly recorded at his home, which he still has, I think, and that he was at home recording, like a demo, really, of four tracks through the...
Yeah.
And going against all the kind of lush George Martin style of recording, although he went back to that later on in his solo career. But, yeah, they... And then going to live in the farm in Scotland with Linda, and then with her daughter, Heather, and then Mary being born. I mean, it was a very different person. And we, meanwhile, John Lennon is with Yoko and doing all this, the art world and the experimental world. George then having great success with All Things Must Pass, Ringo becoming a movie star. And they were all doing very well. It looked like Paul was doing least well in a way. I mean, it seems hard to believe that now.
Yeah.
But it was a very bleak time for him. And he said he was very depressed. And in that song, he's talking about being lonely. And I thought about that. And okay, in the past, rewritten Ellen Rigby had got loneliness in it. But that was a third-person song. This is a first-person love song, talking about being lonely, quite vulnerable, which is not a word you used about any of the Beatles up till then. They'd been our shining examples of positivity and you can do anything you want, we'd change the world. Not loneliness, depression, and that kind of negativity had not been in their songs beforehand. But anyway, this song, maybe I'm amazed. I thought, what does this mean? And I also thought about, do you remember the 10cc song, I'm Not In Love, which came a bit later?
Yeah.
Which, that kind of thing, like, I'm not in love, and a guy pretending he wasn't, and that famous line about, you know, your picture on the wall is just a cover up, a stain in the wallpaper. And that is kind of the way I interpreted Maybe I'm Amazed in the beginning. I thought it was this guy who wants to be too scared to admit and being very offhand, and he didn't want to admit how much he loved this woman. And that's why he was saying, maybe I'm amazed. And it obviously completely untrue as time went on. And it was definitely, to me, the standout track on the album. I didn't mind the fact that it was lo-fi and that he played everything perfectly well to me. And the tune was great. And it had those big bass chords, which even a bit of his early influence of Jerry Lee Lewis on part of that song. So it actually builds and it goes away musically. We don't think it's going to, which is always wonderful when that happens. It just doesn't do anything conventional, and it doesn't do anything very McCartney-ish. And so it's just got kind of tiny bit of blues in there as well. But it's a very complex song. I think it's an indication of what was to come in his solo career. But I don't think it was a single, not to start with. But to me, it was very much a standout track. And then the thing that really impressed me was the Faces. They did a cover version of it in 1971, I think, on long player. Now, the Faces were obviously a brilliant band. Ronnie Wood, Bob Stewart, the Remain, Small Faces, Ian McLagan, a great, great friend of mine, keyboard player. Now, these guys were no innocents in music, and they were the hippest band that we had. Their stock was probably, if I dare say it, probably a lot higher than Paul's was at that time. The significance to me about the Faces including a cover version of Maybe I'm Amazed on their second album was, if you're a musician, you don't make as much money if you do a cover version as you do your own material.
Mm.
And, you know, they've been through this very, very hard time of not earning any money despite their incredible talent and fame. So the fact that they chose to record Maybe I'm Amazed, I remember being incredibly impressed by. And their version obviously is very different because they all play their own instruments and they're all, you know, very, very good at what they did. And Rod Stewart's voice and Paul McCartney's voice are very different. We all know that Rod Stewart's kind of that raspy thing. And he couldn't actually or try to hit the very, ooh, high notes that Paul did in Maybe I'm Amazed. But it fleshed it out and it gave it a different feel. So for quite a long time, I think that became the version that most people knew. And it wasn't till kind of later. I mean, now Paul is playing it now on his current tour.
Amazing, isn't it?
So it's become a McCartney classic, and quite rightly so. But its story to me is fascinating, of what I thought about, well, I thought of it in the beginning, and then the Faces version, and then it coming back within his own repertoire, and it still sounds absolutely terrific.
Because you forget, like, September 69, obviously John announced, "I'm leaving the group, I want a divorce." So Paul had headed up to Scotland with his family and Martha the dog, and he wrote all these songs, and you forget how down he was. But the thing with him, throughout the Beatles, and after this, throughout his whole solo career, he's been the most positive of, well, not just the Beatles, of lots of people. But this is an absolute low ebb for him. And it's, I think that gives the song a certain deepness that others may not have.
And obviously we probably didn't know quite how down he was. I mean, he had done this sort of disappearing and this sort of new family life, which is very opposite of kind of glamorous rock and roll or rock star lifestyle. So it's kind of quite bewildering, but understandable that he would want to get away from everything because it was such an unpleasant time. With all the legal wranglings, and I mean, you know, I was spent a lot of time at Apple around that time, and I remember it was an awful time for everyone. And it's not surprising looking back, but at the time, well, I wouldn't have thought that a Beatle, and you know, until he married Linda, the most desired bachelor, if you like, as you call them, in the world, would end up being feeling so isolated and depressed and miserable. But on the other hand, he's always had all those things around him. And remember, they'd lost Brian Epstein. I always felt that after Brian died, they were incredibly vulnerable because he had looked after them. They'd always had him to turn to. Then when he died, they didn't. And I felt then that the Sharks were moving in and they were very vulnerable, all of them, to people going, "Hey, I'll be your manager. I'll make you lots of money." You know, how gullible they would have been because they'd always had Brian since they'd been teenagers. So that played into it as well, and putting a lot of pressure on Linda to be able to take care of him. I mean, my admiration for her goes up and up over the years because I think it was a very, very tough thing to be Linda. And she had to look after him and pull him out. And she was a photographer. She didn't have experience of that kind of world. And I think that they retreated, in, as you said, to Scotland and for a bit, but it could not have been easy. And him being used to being the centre of the world's attention,
yeah,
and always having people do everything for you, and suddenly he was on his own, and what was he going to do now? Give up everything? Was he going to be any good? And then his first album comes out, not well received. What a blow! You know, and I think with Paul, people say that he always needs reassurance that there's an audience out there for him, and that's why he goes to all the places in the world, because there's people in countries that he's never been that wouldn't know who he is. And that's a concept I find quite fascinating about him. He wants to reach everybody in the world with his songs. Maybe that's how a lot of songwriters feel, but he achieved it in a greater way than anybody has. But the idea that there are still maybe people he can reach out to in far parts of the globe that don't know who he is, I find that fascinating. I actually want to keep the story of the Beatles forever because I think it's such an inspiration. You know, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it. And that, in a way, what happened to him when they broke up and it all turned so hot and nasty and horrible, and that he came back through that, and then it took quite a long time. But Maybe I'm Amazed just stuck with me all those years, and I think there's been probably lots and lots of other covers of it, but I find it very useful, and the layers of it, and the more you know about the story of how it happened and when it happened, makes it more poignant.
Going back to what you were saying about Linda, is if you think throughout the Beatles and throughout, well, after this particular low point in his life, I mean, he was devastated by the breakup of the Beatles. He did have all that reassurance from fans when they were live, you know, and then they released Sgt. Pepper, so they weren't touring, so he'd get reassurance from his peer group and the press and whatnot. And the fact that he hid away and the only reassurance he was getting was from Linda, that's a big ask from Linda.
Well, she's a very strong person. I remember saying to her, you know, when she got all that criticism just because she was Linda McCartney, and she would say, water off a duck's back, and I thought, no, it isn't, Linda. You're just being very brave saying that. But I don't think for a minute she could take all the criticism that she got easily. I really don't. But you need to be a very strong person to be a Beatle companion.
Yeah.
I really think so. I mean, the amount of pressure. I mean, if it was now, it'd be even worse, wouldn't it, with social media? And the fact that she became the person that she became, I mean, at her memorial service, it's the people outside St. Martin in the Fields, women with banners about animal rights, and it was incredible. And I had no idea that that was going to happen. I remember being incredibly moved by it. And she's achieved her own iconic status over the years, and respect, and they had the money to do it. But I remember saying that she was planting a field with just wild flowers. And at the time, nobody was doing that rewilding kind of thing. And so she had very advanced ideas about the environment, about animal welfare, all that kind of stuff, which obviously influenced Paul, and I think he respected her for it. But she had to do all that as well as looking after him, having a family, playing with him in the band, putting up with all the criticism. It's a very tough gig to do,
yeah.
I think, to be Linda. Very, you know, needs to be a very strong woman to cope with that.
So, Annie Nightingale, what does Maybe I'm Amazed mean to you?
Maybe I'm Amazed, as I say, will always be the juxtaposition of Maybe I'm Amazed. It doesn't add up. So it's, to me, it's about that, the wording in the title and the ambiguity of that isn't actually there, that I found that my interpretation of it, but I quite like that, having my own version of it, as I say, like a person who's like too embarrassed, too shy to admit how they feel about you. So they go, well, maybe I'm amazed how much I love you. Maybe I'm afraid to show how much I care. I think that is incredibly endearing. Although it's completely inaccurate and it's nothing like the truth, as Paul wrote it.
And finally, Paul McCartney at 80, why do you think his music has endured for all these years?
Well, that is the most interesting thing, because the contemporaries of the Beatles and of that period, when people were writing fabulous music and very successful, and Pete Townsend doing rock operas and the Kinks writing fabulous songs. And then why did that stop? What was it about songwriting? Unlike painting, you know, if you're Picasso, you didn't suddenly sort of drop off in your technique on your ability to paint when you got to be over 35 or something. I mean, quite the reverse. I've never understood why, apart from maybe Bob Dylan, very few other songwriters have maintained that level of success in touch, keeping in touch with the public all those years. But every now and then, Paul can still do it, like the Valentine one, which I thought was a Paul McCartney classic. And I just think his talent for songwriting, which I don't think he still realises quite how unique that it is one of the few things that's not, age has not made any difference to his ability or his acceptance. I think, I'm sure Ray Davies is still writing great songs, and Pete Townsend, just take two other examples from that, those contemporaries, why those people are not writing songs that are not recognised as much by the public as Paul's are. I don't quite understand that. But I'm very glad that he at least is still accepted, and it's not, oh, well, that was the Beatles, that was years ago. He's irrelevant now. And it's somehow he has managed to stay relevant. And that is very much to be admired. I find that a great inspiration.
Annie Nightingale, thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. Lovely to speak to you again.
Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you can come back for the final part, which will be online on time for Paul's 80th birthday, with lots more guests and lots more Macca favourites. Bye!